The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Lockdown Episode 2. On today's pod, we'll get you up to date with what is and what isn't happening in the world of football as the Belarusian Premier League keeps on going. Sunderland fan Jonathan Wilson and Sunderland fan Barry Glendenning look back at the 1973 FA Cup final. Sideburns, outrageous fouls and a yellow-orange ball. You've sent in buckets of questions and there's Chapter 2 of Detective Wilson. Sam Diss is dead, Wilson is arrested, but which journey did you choose? The Great Escape or Enter the Bear? Find out on today's Guardian Football Weekly. So, as we will normally do on these pods, me and Baz will have a short chat just to check we're both okay, and then we'll crack on with the pod. Hello, Barry.
Hello. Good morning.
Do you want to hear some feedback from the last pod?
Go on, yeah.
Stuck on Six says, I hope Guardian Sport buy Barry a microphone before the next pod with Max. Kev, I just listened to today's masterpiece. Polite feedback. Barry, was he using his laptop's built-in microphone that was in his bedroom while he was chatting away to it from the smallest room? Did the Guardian get your microphone between last pod and this pod, or what?
Well, truth be told, Max, the Guardian had already got me a microphone for Thursday's pod.
Yeah.
I failed to plug it in properly. It emerged after the pod that some of it hadn't recorded properly.
No. So we say some.
Well, all of part one, basically. And we had to re-record our improvised banter, so to speak. And the reason for that, and I got the message from producer Jonathan, we need to re-record part one. And my heart sank into my boots. And I was really, really hoping the reason we would have to re-record part one wouldn't be my fault, but deep down I knew it probably was.
When I suggested on Twitter that we had sent you a microphone, you just failed to plug it in. Matthew said, plug it in quotes, as if he's some tech genius or something. Hashtag realistic expectations. I think many of the listeners, in many ways, it would have been wrong for your audio to have sounded perfect on pod one.
Hopefully it sounds better today. We have done a rigorous pre-pod testing progress,
yes,
or process. Yes, yeah. So, yeah, because I really don't want to have to re-record this embarrassing badinage.
And are you talking into the microphone?
The microphone is pointed towards my face. Yes, I have a little St. Pauli skull and crossbones hanging from the stand just for to add a bit of atmosphere, but you know, so I know what I'm doing.
And how are you finding things, Barry?
I'm okay, actually. It's obviously a weird time. We're all under sort of house arrest. My philosophy is to kind of make the best of it. I see it as an opportunity to try new things, catch up on movies and TV shows I've wanted to see for ages, but I haven't had time because I have to watch loads of football all the time. And I'm eating well. I'm exercising. My alcohol consumption limit has plummeted. It's
all new Barry.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I've realised.
What's that?
I've sort of realised that I've wasted an awful lot of time in the pub. An awful lot of time. And I'm not really missing it. But no doubt that as soon as this is all over, and hopefully it'll be sooner rather than later, I'll be back to the pub with a vengeance.
It got to the stage yesterday where me and my wife were playing a game called The Sound of Eggs, where one of us would have to make the sound of eggs cooking and the other one would have to guess what style of eggs the other person is cooking.
Give me your best poached egg. That's not bad.
Thanks very much. Scrambled egg sounds really sinister, I'll be honest. You try scrambled egg.
Go on.
No, you try it. Sound like a tractor.
or it's like my David Farrar anecdote.
That's the game for everyone to play at home with their loved ones.
How do you do a boiled egg?
Well, a boiled egg is a bit like poached, except with a bit, it's like blah, 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 because sometimes the egg hits the side of the of the pad.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm one of the best in the world at this.
And this is what, day 8 of lockdown?
Something like that.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, just to update you on a couple of things, Rustu Rekber, Turkey's most capped player, former Barcelona keeper, is in a critical period in hospital with COVID-19. We'll keep you updated on his progress. Hope he gets better. And while football is suspended everywhere, it's carrying on in Belarus. On Saturday, there were 6 top-flight games there, including the derby between FC Minsk and Dynamo Minsk, watched by a capacity 3,000 crowd in the capital. There have been fewer than 100 cases and no deaths from COVID-19 in Belarus, got a population of 9.5 million. The decision to carry on has helped the Belarus Football Federation secure broadcasting deals with sports networks in 10 countries, including Russia, Israel and India, where fans have been left with nothing else to watch. Barry, have you gone for the Belarusian Premier League yet?
I haven't, no. I got in a slight bit of bother on Twitter last week for saying I didn't miss football. And I think, to clarify, that was on the back of having watched the second series of Sunderland Till I Die over 2 days, which is enough to put anyone off football. But I think I don't really miss live football, but I have been watching a lot of football-related stuff. As I say, the second series of Sunderland Till I Die, which is on Netflix from April the 1st. And I watched the Diego Maradona documentary at long last, which I'd had recorded from the week before, which I really enjoyed. So I'm engaging quite a lot of football-related activity, but still not missing live football enough to watch the Belarusian League.
And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll ring up Jonathan Wilson and we will look back in detail at the 1973 FA Cup final, Sunderland versus Leeds. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. It's time to look back at the 1973 FA Cup final, and welcome to the pod, Jonathan Wilson. Hey, Wilson.
All right, how are you doing?
How are you, Jonathan? Look how many books you have behind you.
There's another room full of books as well.
Wilson, if I was to push that copy of the Oxford English Dictionary I can see behind you, or maybe it's Collins, would the bookcase swing open and lead to a cave which is full of, silent witness crime boards and whatnot with bits of red string on them?
Well, it hasn't yet, but, I live in hope.
Let's talk about the 1973 FA Cup final. We got together on a Google Hangout, 3 p.m. kickoff on Saturday afternoon. Kevin writes, "What did you do during the pandemic, Daddy? I watched the 1973 FA Cup final to better prepare me for listening to a podcast." Wilson, why did you pick this game?
Well, because it's Sunderland's finest post-war hour. And I think, actually, a genuinely really, really good game. I've seen it maybe half a dozen times before, and I'd sort of forgotten just how frenetic it is. I mean, from minute one, there's big tackles going in. Both sides just attack constantly. Sunderland seem to have no idea of how they should waste time in the final half hour when they really should waste time. Just take the ball in the corner. You don't have to run at the goal. Going in the corner is great. I think it's the best example of the golden age of the FA Cup, when shocks were shocks and this was the big event that everybody watched and everybody really cared about.
Yeah, I mean, to set the scene for anyone who doesn't know, we should probably point out Sunderland were a second division team. Their manager, Bob Stokoe, had taken over the previous November. I think they were fourth from bottom of the second division. Leeds were arguably the finest team in Europe, and nobody gave Sunderland a prayer. Not a prayer. Even in his Yorkshire Post column in the days leading up to this final, their manager, Don Revie, while not outright saying we should win, said Sunderland's, their players will be overawed by the occasion. They're not used to playing at Wembley. I have a team full of international. Leeds are used to playing at Wembley. And I can't see how this occasion won't get to Sunderland. But if anything, it got to Leeds, and they clearly weren't comfortable in their position as white hot favourites for this game.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see that. Yeah, you can always read too much in the body language, but certainly walking out of the tunnel, Leeds players look tense in a way that Sunderland players just seem to be. Everything is a hilarious giggle that they've got there. And, they'd already beaten a very, very good Manchester City side So they drew 2-2 down at Main Road when Jim Montgomery scored an own goal to make it 2-2. Took them back to Roker, and all of that generation of fans say that was the night. That was the greatest night ever at Roker, the best atmosphere, the loudest sound. And it's on YouTube. It's a very sort of grainy black and white footage. And there's an amazing goal from Vic Hallam. So it is worth looking at that. And the story goes, I mean, I have no idea if this is true or not, that Malcolm Allison, the City manager, the next morning, that he broke into Roker Park because he thought there must have been some kind of artificial amplification, because he couldn't believe the football end was that loud. that night, if it had just been that, it still would have been great. And then, you know, they beat Luton in the quarterfinal, which, okay, not as exciting, not as big a shock. And then they play a really good Arsenal side at Hillsborough in the semi and beat them 2-1. And, you know, again, you can watch the highlights. And that's a really good game as well. And Jim Montgomery, Sunderland's goalkeeper, of course, makes the famous brilliant double save in the final. I think he almost has a better game in the semi-final. But yeah, Leeds were the, you know, they had this habit of messing up at the last, but they had been over the previous decade the most consistently excellent side in England and arguably Europe.
Your dad was at the game, Wilson, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. And I showed you the stuffed koala that he took with him.
Yes.
She is still with us. She was given to my parents when they married in 1967. My mum and dad went down. Obviously, the women didn't go to the football in those days. So the wives and girlfriends they end up watching it on a TV shop window on Oxford Street. And my dad went to the game with his mates. And the thing he said, and this is, I mean, anybody who knew my dad, this was very, very characteristic of him. He'd been whistling, and you can hear the whistle from sort of like 80 minutes. You know, there's one of the things we've lost in football with the fourth official putting the board up is you don't have the crowd whistling for a quarter of an hour. So, you know, he'd been whistling with everybody else, and incredible whistles, desperate for it to finish. And then when the referee blows that final whistle, he said his initial reaction wasn't joy, it wasn't euphoria, it was sadness, because he knew it'd never be that good again. And then because he was an accountant, the metaphor he used, he said, what I've done there is I've taken out a massive emotional mortgage I'll be paying back for the rest of my life. And to be honest, I'm still paying it back now.
You mentioned, Jonathan, the game starts, because we did the 86 quarterfinal, and actually it was a bit of a sort of disappointing game, and maybe the heat had something to do with it and the pitch. But this game from the start is relentless. And it is, I mean, it's like an 18 certificate. It is so violent. And like Bremner is like total filth from like the 10th second of the game.
Well, I think there's two extraordinary things with that. One is that although it is incredibly violent to modern eyes, nobody seems to be making a big deal of it. So that I think is just what football was. I think football was a much more physical sport. But then there's a moment, I think about 12 or 13 minutes in, when Leeds have four shots in the space of about 10 seconds and Sunderland players just hurling themselves in the way, blocking everything. And David Coleman doing the BBC commentary, and I actually think Brian Moore's commentary on ITV is better, but anyway, David, we watched the BBC version. David Coleman doing the commentary compares it to soldiers going over the top. And there is that sort of sense of this sort of people really kind of chucking themselves in the way of absolutely everything. You know, nobody wants to give a fraction.
Ian Porterfield, who I sort of know as a Panini sticker as a manager, seemed to me one of the few players who had sort of poise and control in an otherwise sort of chaotic match, Barry.
I think that's slightly unfair, Max, because while we were watching the game on Saturday, I asked Wilson why were there were a few Sunderland players who stood out, and I was asking Wilson why were they playing in the second division, why weren't they at top flight, and he suggested maybe it's because some of them were quite early in their careers and they did go on to have more play with more distinguished sides, if you pardon the expression. But I thought Dave Watson was arguably man of the match, even though he didn't make the headlines. That was Porterfield and Montgomery. His wife has recently revealed he's suffering from a neurodegenerative disease, which is sad, and we wish him well. Ian Porterfield obviously stood out. Jim Montgomery was lauded for that amazing save. He was a, an excellent goalkeeper, although I thought some of his handling in that game was a little bit suspect, but he did make a couple of astounding saves, and Dennis Stewart was brilliant for Sunderland as well. So I do think it's a little unfair to suggest that they didn't have any standout calm players.
And Wilson, just talk through that Leeds side as well, because obviously lots of people listening are way too young to even remember the 70s and this side. We've mentioned quite how good they were, but they had some superstars, didn't they?
Oh, they really did. I mean, I think they had an international in every position.
Was it Trevor Cherry who started? Was the only one?
Yes, Trevor Cherry obviously played in the 1970 World Cup. I guess if you're being critical, they probably missed Jack Charlton a bit, which allows Sunderland to sort of rough them up with balls in the box. But they got Paul Madeley playing alongside Norman Hunter at centre back, and Norman Hunter obviously often played in midfield. But they and Eddie Gray, who I think had a lot of injury problems that season, a great winger, but he had a very very quiet game. And I don't know if that was sort of the after effects of the injury or what. And he goes off for Terry Yorath in the end. But Bremner, is one of the greatest holding midfielders that the British football has known. Very tough, reads the game really well, but a good passer of the ball as well. You got John Giles, one of the greatest Irish players of all time. A great footballing intelligence, fantastic on the ball. Peter Lorimer, famously with his 70 mile an hour plus shot, not that it helped against Montgomery. Alan Clark, one of the greatest poachers in the history of the game. So it's just a team packed with stars. But I actually agree with you about Porterfield. I think Porterfield was he was the one who was able to slow the game down. His story is incredible. I mean, I think we sort of forget about him after. I think I'm right in saying he was the first Premier League manager to be sacked, which from Chelsea, which happened after there was a game when they were 2-0 up, I think, at home against Norwich, and ended up losing 3-2. And Dave Besant has a nightmare. And I'm pretty sure he was the first Premier League manager sacked. But he then has this incredible sort of itinerant career. He goes to Zambia. I think that's his first job after Chelsea. Zambia, who just suffered the air crash, and he helps put together Zambia. He had a lot of problems with alcohol. Was involved in a very serious car crash. He coached in South Korea, I think in Busan, and he ends his career in Armenia as Armenian national coach. By which time he knows he has terminal cancer, and he's become quite a profound Christian. And his apartment in Armenia was it overlooked Eshmiadzin, which is the oldest extant Christian temple in the world. I think third or fourth century It was an old Greek-style temple that they converted to Christianity. And he ends his life in this apartment overlooking the earliest ever Christian temple. A remarkable story, which I think is not particularly well known.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. You've mentioned that double save from Jim Montgomery. And it is. And I asked this to you earlier, I'm trying to think of great saves in the FA Cup final or great saves at Wembley and where that stands in the pantheon of great saves. Because the second save is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, obviously Lorimer could probably score, but it's still an amazing save.
Yeah, I mean, if I think of FA Cup final saves, there's only two that stand out for me, and there probably are others that I've forgotten, but Dave Besson saving from John Aldridge for Wimbledon from the penalty spot in that famous FA Cup final is one that leaps to mind. But it was incredible. I mean, the Sunderland fullback Paul Reaney crosses the ball. Trevor Cherry heads it, and it's a brilliant save from Montgomery, although perhaps he should have held on to it. But anyway, and then the ball drops beautifully for Peter Lorimer. He's got pretty much the entire goal to fire into, and he hits it sweetly enough. And he has since said that if he could go back and do it all again, he probably would have hit it the same way again. He turns to celebrate this equaliser, but Montgomery has somehow got up and got an arm up and manages to touch the ball onto the crossbar, and it bounces out. And it was an astonishing save. Lorimer thought he'd scored. The commentator thought he'd scored. I presume everyone in the ground and his teammates thought he'd scored. But Montgomery keeps it out somehow. And Cherry and Lorimer are just there with their hands on their head, unable to believe how this ball has not gone into the gaping goal.
Yeah, well, I think it's sort of testament to what a literally incredible save it was, that both David Coleman and Brian Moore both say, and it's 1-1. Yeah, they can't believe it hasn't gone in. And I think it's Jimmy Hill doing the co-commentary on ITV. And yeah, if you watch that, it takes him to a second replay, so the third time he's seen it, before he accepts that the ball hasn't gone in. He thinks initially the ball must have hit the back of the net and bounced out. That seems him more plausible than Montgomery getting back across and getting his wrist to the ball and turning up under the bar. The point about should he have held the first header, I think maybe with modern gloves that would be possible, but you've got to bear in mind he's wearing these weird green cotton gloves.
They're so good.
I can't see how they would ever have helped, but it's what goalkeepers wore in those days. But he's also, he's gone across goal as Rini's cross has come in. He's gone across goal. He's had to turn back. So he's moving to his right, then he turns back to his left. And he gets two decent hands on it. So could he have pushed it slightly further out of the danger zone? I don't know. I think maybe. But then, yeah, he somehow manages to not only spring up, but to sort of anticipate the angle of the shot. So he sort of turned back, and he's going back towards his own goal and manages to push up. I mean, incredible strength in his wrist as well, I think.
Can you think of any better saves? Because the Besant one, I think it was the first penalty save in a cup final, if I'm right.
In a Wembley Cup final, of course. Yeah. Sunderland missed a penalty against Aston Villa in 1913.
Yeah, I was thinking, obviously I knew that one, but I thought Besant's was quite a nice height.
Actually, sorry, keeper. I think Villa missed it against Sunderland, but Villa won it 1-0. Sorry.
Yeah, I didn't want to correct you, but it's okay. But I thought Besant's save was quite a nice height, really, from Aldridge. Obviously it's a momentous moment because it's saving a penalty, but it's slightly different, I think. Maybe there just aren't lots of brilliant cup final saves.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of another one remotely equivalent to it. I mean, in terms of saves at Wembley, or it just general sort of performances, and it's weird because it's obviously, 6 months later, Tomaszewski's performance against England mm-hmm. is a thing of a similar ilk. It's slightly chaotic. He's not the cleanest keeper, but somehow he manages to get in the way of everything. And of course, Alan Clark was on the receiving end that day as well.
Should Leeds have had a penalty?
Yeah, probably. I mean, we haven't seen a replay of it. We only see it once. It's in, full speed. But Bremner sort of cuts inside onto his right foot. Dave Watson is a little bit clumsy. Bremner goes down. I think probably he's jumped over the leg, but I think in the modern age we'd think it was a foul. But then Bremner doesn't really complain about it. And I kind of think that if you're Leeds and you've spent the last sort of 10, 12 years putting pressure on referees, chucking yourself to the ground, maybe if you stop getting decisions off referees, maybe it's your own fault. Maybe that's just karma working itself out.
It's interesting, actually, because in the build-up to the game, Bob Stokoe had... I suppose in the modern day they'd be called mind games, but he very much won the battle of the pre-match mind games. And he had said publicly that following Leeds' semi-final win over, I think it was Wolves, he had criticised the manner in which Bremner had sort of acted as assistant referee. He was constantly in the ear of the ref. And he said that, I hope Ken Burns, who was the referee for the final, I hope Ken Burns makes the decisions and not Billy Bremner. So I suspect that could have possibly, I'm speaking with the benefit of 2020 hindsight. I was 7 weeks old when this game was played, so I remember it every detail, including that of the build-up. But yeah, maybe that had a little influence.
Who's Sunderland's right back? He looks about 100.
Dick Malone, who's also, I think, had a really good game in a sort of understated way. But yeah, everybody looks really old. I mean, it's a sobering thought that Bob Stokoe then is slightly more than a year younger than I am now. And yet he looks like an old man.
I couldn't believe that when you said it on Saturday, Wilson, because I assumed he was in his 60s. But yeah, he was, what, 42?
42, yeah. And yeah, he famously wore the tracksuit. Yeah, there's a bit in the commentary when he's... I think it's on Brian Moore's commentary when he says, the very definition of a tracksuit manager. Like, you know, he looks like your granddad looked when you were a kid. You know, like,
and at the end of the game, he runs onto the pitch, and this is now, you know, a statue outside the stadium, alight in bronze. But he's wearing red tracksuit bottoms, a brown overcoat, like sort of a Mac, and a trilby. It's
just a few other things from this game that I really like. I love the LUFC, the letters on Leeds top going down diagonally. I loved the Sunderland warm-up tops with their full name just in sort of bold letters, capital letters on the back of them. Don Revy's jacket, like the biggest furry, he was wearing a bear, basically.
He looked like a pimp. And,
yeah, you wouldn't be surprised if he walked up to you in a pub and tried to sell you some knockoff gold watches. I think it's also, I'm not absolutely certain about this, but I think it's the first time Leeds wore the sock tags with the numbers on, because they were definitely wearing them the following season. And I don't think they wore them earlier this season. So I think this was the debut for the famous sock tags, which were designed by Paul Trevelyan, who drew You Are the Ref.
Oh, wow. Lots of Leeds fans got in touch saying, why don't you follow it up next week with the 1975 European Cup final? Also, what about last year's playoff semi-final second leg against Derby? And when socially distancing is lifted, you could just kick me in my actual face. Matt says, the Cup final watch-along reminds me of a campaign they once had to do at the Stadium of Light on match days, because it was rife with pickpockets who'd worked out that seemingly every Sunderland supporter had the same PIN number on their bank card, 1973, which is brilliant. And Emmett says, I've been confined now for 2.5 weeks in Washington, D.C. I have several friends with the virus. Watching these classic matches has been an amazing thing to look forward to. I watch on a Sunday night. Thank you. And he says, were careers shorter in the 70s? Hashtag tackles. Lots of people saying that they've appreciated it. It's really fun when people watch along with us. So we'll do it again next weekend. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up your questions. Chapter two of Detective Wilson as well. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So all the football in England below the three divisions that make up the National League will end immediately. All results have been expunged. There'll be no promotion or relegation in these leagues. The same's happening in the women's game below the WSL and Championship level. However, the National League, National League North and South, WSL and Women's Championship will continue towards a conclusion as quickly as possible. A couple of examples of teams who've really been incredibly unlucky here. Jersey Bulls had won all 27 of their matches in the combined counties Football League Division 1 were 20 points clear at the top. Northern Premier League Division leaders South Shields FC, 13 points clear for promotion to the National League North, but will now spend another campaign in Tier 7 of English football. One story from over the weekend, an investigation has been launched after pictures of the Aston Villa midfielder Jack Grealish surfaced online following an incident in which a Range Rover crashed into parked cars. West Midlands police say they were called to the Dickens Heath area of Sully Hall on Sunday, just before 10 o'clock in the morning, where two parked cars suffered minor damage. The force said the driver left his details with a member of the public before leaving on foot. To Positivity Corner, lots of football teams. We mentioned Watford in the last pods are giving up their facilities to the NHS. Manchester City are giving use of the facilities at the Etihad. The Principality Stadium in Cardiff has been converted into a temporary 2,000-bed hospital. Plymouth have handed over Home Park for non-emergency purposes to ease the strain on the NHS. Spurs defender Toby Alderweireld is trying to bring a little bit of joy, he says, to those with COVID-19 by donating tablets to hospitals and nursing homes. He's already paid for dozens of devices, has more on the way for those who are isolated. When we're all out of this, I'd quite like to have an iPad given to me by Toby Alderweireld.
There are quite a lot of just little things which I've quite enjoyed over the past few days. You know, I saw footage of Carlo Ancelotti basically sitting down. He was calling up elderly Everton fans just to have a chat, see how they were, and there was a recording of him having a conversation with this old boy, and who kept addressing him as Mr. Ancelotti, and Ancelotti's going, no, you got to call me Carlo. You know, when you reach a certain age, you know, you don't need to call me Mr. Ancelotti. I'm Carlo. But the guy kept insisting on calling him Mr. Ancelotti. Also seen players, I think you had one on the radio last week, various players reading bedtime stories.
Yeah, Joe Worrell, the Nottingham Forest centre-back, they've been doing it for on their Facebook page, but yeah, I got him to read The Very Hungry Caterpillar on TalkSport. He was so good at it as well. When he said pop, he really gave it everything.
And I know Norwich City and probably other teams as well have all given their players like a list of elderly season ticket holders and, you know, give them a call, have a chat with them and blah. You know, it's just nice little touches. It doesn't take a huge amount of effort. It gives the players something to do and it makes the fans happy. It's you know, you can't fault it in any way.
Alan says, what does Wilson think of Netflix's The English Game? Was he a tactics consultant on the live sequences? Does he approve of the merging of different teams' histories to create one TV-friendly narrative?
Okay, I mean, it is one of the worst things I've ever seen. It is utterly dreadful. I sort of understand the merging of clubs' histories, but I understand why, if you're a Blackburn Olympic fan, that would really, really annoy you. I guess there aren't that many Blackburn Olympic fans around these days. But I do get you have to do that for narrative purposes. And, you know, missing out the first replay between Darwin and Old Etonians, again, I get for dramatic reasons why you would do that. And in terms of the look of the football, I think it's not actually that bad. You know, it's quite hard for us to conceptualise what 19th century football looked like. But I think they do get a reasonable handle on that. But my objection to it is actually the basics of the drama, which is the dialogue is utterly, utterly horrific. Again, I accept that, and me particularly, the football bits of the dialogue, the exposition you have to put in there, it's always going to sound like chopped up bits of Inverting the Pyramid spoken in a Glaswegian accent. So the bits when Fergie Souter, the professional, has come down from Partick to join Darwin, when he suddenly goes, hey, football is a game about space. And you sort of think, Barney takes a piss out of me for saying that in every column. And there's a man in a TV drama saying it. Hey, football is a game about space. And they do this, so it's just ridiculous stuff. So he's explaining how you shouldn't all be bunching around the ball. But he does that at a kickoff when Old Etonians about to kick off and about to just drive through the centre with all their players. No, you don't want somebody standing on the left wing then. You want him in the middle to block that. When you get possession, you got to win the ball back, Fergie. And Craig Parkinson, you know, who played Cotton in Line of Duty, and ironically, he now is the owner of a cotton mill, and this whole kind of search for H, he can't even say the letter H anymore. The whole thing's about, oh no, banks foreclosed on loan. We're going to have to close mill. I will watch it, obviously, but it is utterly, utterly awful. And I think almost contemptuous. It's almost like they said, you know what, this crap will do for football fans. But like Mrs. Brown's boys, and they don't give a shit about proper dramatic development, proper dialogue, plausibility. Just show them a ball being kicked about, that'll do.
Off Menu, the podcast that Ed Gamble and James Acaster do, they tweeted out the podcast charts, of which Corona Newscast is 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4 and 3 in the charts. We're second and they're top. And Nish Kumar tweeted, I absolutely love that you idiots are all keeping coronavirus podcasts off the top spot. Now, before we get to chapter 2 of Detective Wilson, Wilson, you yourself are helping writers, aren't you?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, a lot of freelancers, I think, are finding things quite difficult at the minute, particularly sports freelancers. With the no sport being no sport to write about, and you know, obviously if you don't have a contract, then it's very hard to get any money coming in at all. So what we've done at the Blizzard is we've set up a new magazine. It's called The Squall, because it's smaller than the Blizzard. It's going to be about a quarter of the length of the Blizzard. It's going to be digital only. It'll come out in the months when Blizzard doesn't come out. So Blizzard comes out March, June, September, December. Squall will come out those other 8 months during the year. So we've set up a bank account and a PayPal account purely for Squall. So a lot of people who wrote for Blizzard last year have waived their fees for last year, and that money's gone into those accounts. And then obviously we need readers to buy the magazine. It'll be pay what you want. If anybody could donate before that, that would be fantastic. It's taking a little bit of time to set up the account to get more verified. I hope that'll be done later today. I'll tweet out the details of that, but you know, if you could support that, because a lot of freelancers have suddenly found that their supply of employment has been totally cut off. So this is, you know, we're not going to be able to pay huge amounts to many people, but it's something. and hopefully the sort of football community can rally around and help people.
And if it's quarter the length of the Blizzard, it will still be very long.
Yes, it's going to be about 20,000 words long. And the first issue is all about right-backs.
Tony Hibbert?
We had a lot of pictures about Tony Hibbert. But no, Tony Hibbert is not going to be there.
On the subject of Detective Wilson, then, Joe Barton, the screenwriter, if you remember, he did an interview where he said, if you really want to be a screenwriter, you're better off reading Barney Ronay. Wilson put his head in his hands at that moment. He's been in touch, Joe, to say, although more evidence that Jiri Hadji was a silly title that no one can pronounce or remember, I was very excited to get quoted in Football Weekly about my admiration for Barney Ronay. I'm available to adapt Detective Wilson into a 10-part Netflix show if Max is up for it. Well, I mean, 100% and more. He's late to the party, listening to Monday's pod and chapter one of Detective Wilson's. Two questions. Is Jamie Biddle, who is the author of Detective Wilson, Steve Bruce's pseudonym? And he makes an interesting point. Would Mark Langdon have brown sauce on his bacon sandwich? Because it is derived from fruit, isn't it? Now, Wilson, you heard chapter one of Detective Wilson. How did you feel about it?
Really disturbed. I was sitting there listening to it, thinking this is quite weird, but I'm quite flattered by this. This is great. And then, I get taken to Root Hall, and the thought crossed my mind, I think I've only been to Root Hall once when Sunderland played there, 1-1 Ian Sampson goal, 70 minutes, 71 minutes, something like that, from a corner, in 1992. And I got arrested. And then what happens? I get arrested again at Root Hall. So I've only been arrested twice in my life. Once actually, and once kind of in this fiction. And both times been at Root Hall. I tell you this, I'm never going there again. I will not go to the South End.
Why were you arrested in real life?
Oh, it was very, very tedious. I used to sell the Sunderland fanzine, and because we had a circulation below a certain amount and came out less than 12 times a year, it's less than monthly, we were allowed to sell it on a public highway under the terms of, I think, the 1968 Trade Act, although, don't turn to me for legal advice. And a policeman tried to move me on, as often happened. And obviously, being a chippy little 16-year-old, I cited the 1968 Trade Act at him, at which he pointed out I was about 10 yards the wrong side of a gate and nicked me for being a cocky twat.
Okay, anyway, it's time for chapter two of Detective Wilson. I put a Twitter poll up for Le Great Escape or Enter the Bear, Choose Your Own Journey, and 63% voted Enter the Bear. Here is chapter two of Detective Wilson, Enter the Bear. Wilson sat alone in interrogation room 3 awaiting DCI Glendenning. He'd known the Bear for a long time. They'd come up together through the same academy and into the first team of fighting crime. They were an unstoppable pairing. In this very room, they had worn down the defences of even the hardest of criminals. Baz playing the Heskey role, making holes in their story and setting Wilson up to sidefoot home with the killer question. They were good times, but he was old enough to know the good times never last. Right on cue, the door opened. But standing before him was not a bear, but a cat. A Cheshire cat, to be precise. Rushton. Crown Court's very own Max Rushton. Obsequious little shit that had boot... Obsequious little shit that had bootlicked his way to the top. Everyone had met Max seemed to love him, but Wilson saw through it. Prosecutor Rushton was power-hungry, ruthless, and would do whatever it took to reach the top. "Well, this is a bit of a pickle, isn't it, John?" he said sympathetically. Searching for a tell on Wilson's face, a weak point in his armour, a David Luiz in his back line. "I haven't been in Southend since May 2019. You won't have me on CCTV. You have no forensics. And on top of everything, Max, you haven't got a motive. This is textbook Carol Poborski." "Poborski?" Rushton inquired. "A non-starter." Wilson knew he had the upper hand in this shootout, but for some reason, Max kept smiling. A knowing smile, as though he were 3-0 up and about to bring on John Obi Mikel. "Knows forensics," he replied. "Is that so?" He then placed an evidence bag on the table, smeared with the devil's red. The lapsed investigator allowed himself a glance. He only needed one, because inside was something he knew very well. Something he had seen on a daily basis for 2.5 years. His Football Supporters Federation award from 2017, and it was covered in blood. "So here's the thing, John. With this bit of evidence, the game is pretty much a formality. It's City in the League Cup final. It's Dyche playing 4-4-2. It's a sure thing. So why don't we make it easy and get to the heart of the matter? Why did you kill Sam Diss? Before Wilson had time to respond, the door swung open and the bear's enormous frame filled it, his face like thunder. 70 fecking minutes, DCI Glendenning boomed, nearly taken off Rushton's skin. What's that, Baz? Max said sheepishly. That is how long I've been waiting in my office, where this interview was meant to take place. His fury was palpable. Oh, sorry. Must have missed your message. Sincere apologies. I, said Max, flustered. Shut up and get out, you fecking Oxbridge tart. Max stood up, smiled at them both, and slinked towards the door. Wilson couldn't resist. Max? The prosecutor spun around, seemingly unfazed. Yes, John? Let me give you some advice. If you go looking for a giant killing in this game and you're not ready, you're liable to be turned over. You remember that. For a split second, his mask slipped. Rushton's face went from Ronaldinho to Roy Keane, but then the grin returned and he finally took his leave. The bear sat down in front of Wilson. He looked harried and haggard. It had been a rough morning for them both, it seemed. With an enormous effort, he finally broke the silence. Did you kill him? Wilson just stared. Did you fecking kill him? You know I didn't, Baz. Someone's setting me up. He looked towards the evidence bag. Well, who the fuck was it then? Glendenning demanded. I don't know. Not yet. Look, I know I've been on the bench for a while, but I'm ready to get back out there. Have you gone fecking barmy? He snapped. I can't put the main suspect on the case now, can I? Look, Baz, I'm the only chance you've got. I'll find Sam Diss's killer. I can win us this. You've got to trust me. Barry pulled out a cigarette and popped it in his mouth. He lit it up, took a lungful, and weighed his old strike partner one more time, finally looking at him as he used to, as a friend. I can give you 3 days. After that, the smug little prick will be back with a court order and I'll be marked out of the game. Wilson stood outside FWPD Towers and enjoyed the sunrise. He had 3 days to close the case. He thought about the faceless murderer. You thought this was 90 minutes? You thought it was done? You didn't finish off your chances? And now it's the second leg. All I need is one piece of evidence and I'm back in it on away goals. He made a silent promise to the late Sam Diss and got to work. Detective Wilson was out of retirement and back on the case. Choose your next move. A, back to League One. B, the belly of the beast. I'm slightly disappointed I'm an obsequious shit.
Kind of typecast, aren't you, Max?
Look, we'll do a poll again on Sunday or Saturday at some point over the weekend for Chapter 3. On Thursday, it is Barry Reed's La Bamba, so oh, I'm looking forward to that, and that'll do for today. Barry, thanks for your time, mate.
Thanks. I'm really enjoying these little diversions from, the relative tedium of house arrest. Mm.
Cheers, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
And look out for Wilson's Twitter, especially for freelance football writers or people who like reading the Blizzard and want to help in a little way. You can do it just at John A. Wills on Twitter. And that'll do for today. We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.